This is Catherine McKay. It is March 1st, 2005. I am sitting in the office of Jim Bird in the education building, but actually Jim is connecting with Child and Family Studies. And I know from talking to other people, Dr. Bird, that you are what is called an early adopter. That is, you're one of the first on this campus to really embrace technology as a tool for teaching, not just as a tool for doing your own work. And so it has been recommended that I interview you. So I'm going to ask you just a couple of questions to start so we can hear your voice on the tape, and then you can tell me stories. I would like to know where and when you got your degree. And when you came to Weber State, so let's fill in a little bit of the academic career piece first.
Okay, I completed a bachelor's degree at Brigham Young University in psychology, and then I went back a couple of years later and completed a master's degree in child development and family relations at Brigham Young University. I left there and was involved in a children's program in Seattle. And then got involved at Washington State University in Ellensburg. And got interested once again still in children's program. Was hired by Weber State as an assistant professor, but with my primary job to be the director of the children's school in the Department of Child and Family Studies.
All right, you were talking about coming here at Weber State. The date, the year, please?
That'd be fall of 1978, so August, September of 1978. We're on the border system right now.
Sure.
And so I landed as the director of the children's school.
Not on the faculty. This was an administrative...
I was an assistant professor, but I had a half-time administrative role as the director of the children's school, half-time teaching.
How'd you get interested in using technology for teaching?
Through the children. Through children, yeah. Probably goes back to Paul. By the way, I have an original poem, if you remember that. So what I noticed with Pong, that it immediately caught on, even though if you've ever seen a Pong compared to what we have now, and all it was, well, the thing that went back and forth across the screen, or it even gave it just illusion that it went back and forth across. So I saw that the children, young children, probably school-age children, were very, very interested, as I was. And then Atari came out with their little program games. In fact, Atari, I think, developed Pong. And Atari developed these just games for kids. But what they also did was they developed a computer. At that time, it was called microcomputers. And in microcomputers included any, what we refer to now as PCs. Personal computers. These are called microcomputers. And Atari came out with their version of microcomputer, similar about the same time that Apple came out with this, and Commodore came out with theirs, and things like that. But what caught me with Atari was that it had a computer, but it also had the standalone games, almost like what we still have now. And so I knew that some of the games they had that was catching on, like, Wildfire, that the computer was being used to design these games. So back in 1981, I wrote one of the first grants on campus to get what was called a microcomputer. And again, I was in charge of the children's school, and my idea was that I would develop programs that were more educational in format for preschool children. And I brought Tom Day along with me, And we started, I ordered this computer. I had never touched a computer prior to that. I mean, going back to my days in college and graduate school, you know, the computers were these huge machines that used key punches and things like that. I didn't know computing that much. Fortran a little bit, but that's not what you used on these computers. You had a language called BASIC. So I went over to what is called Advanced Contracts now and said, here's my idea. So I wrote a letter to Atari. I have the original grant, by the way.
Oh, that's great.
And said, this is what I need. And I didn't even know what I needed. At that time, I think I called Bob Kaepner. I said, Bob, what am I going to need? And he really didn't seem to know that much either. So we ordered a, I ordered what then was called an Atari 800. It had an 8K of memory. My watch has more than that. But I knew I was going to need a huge computer, so I asked for them to double, so 16K. Along with that, I got a cassette tape that's what you programmed on. And Bob told me, you know, you may want one of these things called a disk drive. I said, why would I want one of those? He says, because they're quicker than a cassette tape. Used actual cassettes in these tapes. And I said, well, I don't think a disk drive would ever catch on. I think people are going to be too interested in just using what they're familiar with, and they'll use cassette tapes. And so he said, well, go ahead. He encouraged me to get the disk drive, so I got the disk drive too. So I got, wrote Atari, I said, I need two computers. They had it was called an Atari 800 and Atari 400. Atari 400 had an interesting keyboard that it was like a film, like what you see in McDonald's now, where there was no chiplet keys. It was just this film press. And I wanted that for kids to use with the children now in children's school so they wouldn't get things caught in the chiplet keys. But I wanted the 800 so I could program them. So Atari just said, sure. All we require of you is when you write your program, send them to us. They had an open domain site. So I get this equipment. It arrives basically by mail. No one on campus knows, really, what it's all about. And once again, I dragged Bob over. He and I and Tom were sitting in a little room down at Children's School trying to plug in the appropriate apparatus and this interesting thing called the disk drive. And actually, Atari really had an open-end system that you could deal with all the peripherals separately. And that made it really important for kids because what I could actually have them do back then is I could tape something and they could listen through the tape that came through the computer, through my little tape machine on the computer, and then it would instruct them to type things in, and then that would also be interacting with the disk drive. I mean, it was as complex now, although it only had 16K memory. It's pretty interesting. So when I got it, Tom Day and I started trying to figure out how to program. And with that, we had over instructional development, a woman who was director of instructional development at that time, her name was Joan Kerfus, was very interested in what we're doing. So what I ended up doing is setting up a workshop for faculty on how to use PCs. With that, I also set up it became a class just for faculty and staff. And we ran that in a very small room right down the hall, 240. We had, I think Harry came aboard at that time and maybe joined us. And in order to teach this class, I used my Atari that I had. Tom and I went down to the hi-fi shop and they loaned us a Commodore. I was able to get hold of a Macintosh, or it wasn't a Macintosh, it was an Apple II, not even a 2 Plus, it wasn't a 2E. And so we had three or four different computers that had at least three different operating systems. And Tom and I would drag them into the class room, hook them all up, the faculty and staff would come in, and we'd teach them how to do it. And what we were really doing is teaching basic programming. However, at that particular time, I think it was out of Harvard, a group of people came out with a program called VisiCalc. don't know if you remember that, his first spreadsheet. And I was able to get a copy of his account, and it was open source. Those people could make gazillion dollars. If you ever used Excel, that's all it is. It's an Excel program. Excel is a ripoff of Visicom. And so I started incorporating ways to manage records for faculty. And then I used a database system. I can't remember what database system it was. So we could manage addresses. And with that, we started producing a little newsletter called the Peripheral. On campus, microcomputer again. It's my first class I put together, application microcomputers. So I did an experimental class from a little faculty staff seminar class I ran. Then I started an experimental class. It was like a 281 class, and we did that as for students, and it really caught on. But really, what we're doing is we're teaching programming at. Around that time, a book came out called about Logo. Logo is an interactive computer language. It was designed by, I had the last name of Papert. And it became a very effective program that allowed children to program and conceptualize geometrical principles. And so I got very excited about that. Of course, that was right down the alley of teachers. How do you write a program that just wasn't games? Now what you want to do is get children to be able to conceptualize something through the microcomputer. And so we started bringing in these logos, this program called Logo. And again, you did all sorts of fun geometrical things. I tried to actually get a robot that you would program the computer and robot. I had a grant for that. Bob, he's great. Anyway, we tried to get this little robot so we could get the kids interactive. And that's how it really became more than just a toy. It was how do we get kids to children, adults, teachers, to see what the power of this computer can do. And from there, I developed a class on campus called Marketing Computers and Education. It was a joint class from our department, Child and Family Studies, and Teacher Education. It became a required class for a long time. It finally was just incorporated in other classes because computers became so sophisticated, nobody knew about programming. Various programs so teachers could go out into the community, go out in their classroom and develop interactive games, instruct children. I remembered I taught my daughter a little program. She was 9 years old, maybe even a little younger. And she came home one day and she goes, Daddy, you taught me how to program to where I could type this little program and then all I have to do is say, you know, type my name, Bryden, and then it would just print out a whole bunch of Brydens, and just, you know, this continuous loop. And I said, yeah. And she goes, how do you do that again? So we sat down, I showed her how to do that in a little basic program. And then I saw her, she wasn't typing in Bryden, she was typing in, I will not talk in class. And it printed it out on the paper of 100 times, so what she was supposed to evidence the punishment the teacher was giving. And I thought, you know, how do I get upset with my daughter who has figured out the advantage of a computer before her teacher at the age of 9? That's pretty cool. Yeah. From there, we had a problem on campus. We had these ancient computers. They're called Harris computers. And the campus, even before that, the campus started realizing that the computer system was not friendly. And it was very limited. Again, it seemed like the Fortran was driving it. And so I was asked to be the chairman of the Academic Community Committee. And that was involved with Eric Jacobson at the time. And our job at that time was trying to figure out how do we go go to the next step? How do we get this campus to start embracing computers, to get computers that we do have friendly? And so we put together a committee, got quite a bit of money from, in fact, it still exists now. And what we had to do is we designed a whole new system for the campus, a whole new system for individuals. And I think we saw that the need for microcomputers, called PCs. I don't know if you notice that PCs, that term is usually referring to those that are window-driven systems.
Right.
Whereas Macintosh or Apple's, they're all bunched together at that time. First starting out. I still like to use my computer, and I still use it, people don't know all the time. So we decided that what we needed is computer labs for students to really get them available. We just, people didn't have access to computers, and so we set up, at that time, got enough funding to set up something like four different computer labs using individual computers. That's where I left off. I was eventually told that computers probably wasn't my realm of business, that I better stick with early childhood. Because at that time, if you heard my introduction, I got my master's degree. And I was hired here with a master's degree, but they changed the policy on campus. I needed a doctorate, so they said I needed a doctorate. I asked if I could get a doctorate in computer technology and education, and they said no, I would not fit with this department. So I continued to get my doctorate in psychology.
Where's your doctorate from?
University.
One of the things that I'm curious about, and I want to hear what you think about this, it must have been kind of exciting in the period that you're talking about, where you really are programming and you're really thinking through, in some ways, both philosophical and pragmatic issues about can the computer help me do a better job as a teacher? Can computer help a child be a stronger learner, and looking at ways perhaps more imaginatively, I guess what I'm trying to make a distinction between is that I wonder if you have thought about, we seem to be more and more distanced from the actual workings of the computer, as they become more sophisticated and they do more things, fewer of us can literally take control. It's sort of that Zen in the art of motorcycle medium. We can't take apart the motorcycle, we can't take apart the computer. But also, now that we move to this online delivery system, on some campuses, the instructor is different than the designer, who's different than, you know, we're even more distanced from the actual mechanism by which we teach. Do you think that changes the way we think about computers and teaching? Do you think we get less imaginative about it, or where do you?
I don't know. I think it has its advantages and disadvantages on both sides of the coin. You know, it's interesting. Probably around 1988, somewhere around that. So I was involved in it heavily for maybe 5 to 10 years. And then it just started leapfrogging. If I didn't stay on top of it, I lost it, which I have. I don't know how my current computer works. I don't have any of that knowledge. But it's almost similar to me, if I were to use an analogy like an automobile. When I was a kid, I used to really get into automobiles. You know, I wanted to build engines faster, put in different transmissions and all that. And I had a very good working understanding of the automobile. And you know, I had an old Volkswagen bus that if I ever broke down, I could repair it with a, and literally did, with baling wire. had to do that sometimes. But I'll tell you, I'd never trade Marlene Miller calling out for one of those. They can do much more. Do I know? Could I repair one? No, I couldn't repair one. Do they curb my imagination? I just didn't need my imagination. So it can go either way. It really can. With the computer system, the thing that was always of interest to me is that can it really do things that you otherwise could not do. And I want to give you an example that I felt was the problem with computers. I learned this early on. In about 1984, I was asked by Gwinnett School District, because I was a school psychologist, to come and look at how they were doing their IEPs, their individual education plans, for children who were actually in the youth and custody program. Because they wanted me to examine the software that would maintain the records among these kids. These were kids in youth and custody. So if they're in special ed in grad school district, most of these kids are very transient. And then they left grad school and came up to Ogden or then were incarcerated. How would, by the time you've got the records transferred, the kids were gone. And so teachers were never able to meet these children's needs because they're always waiting for the records. And so they wanted me to come and look at a way to manage through the computers where the teacher could just type in a few keywords and get access to records immediately. But we weren't as concerned about personal protection of personal information.
Right.
There was not all the scary stuff going on.
Yeah.
So I went in there, and it was interesting. They were showing me this system, and they're typing in all this information. They took an example student, and typed in the IEP configured all this educational stuff, and it printed out a 15-page document on a child for the individual educational plan. And I looked at that, and I said, that's overload. There is no way a teacher would touch that. You've given them way too much information, and it's not all good information. And so what the teacher needs to do now, and she has 15 pages of document, but what you've also put the teacher in is in a position that she's responsible for it. And so you've increased her, almost her liability, but did not provide her with any useful information. And they debated that already. No, they'll love it. So we called in a special ed teacher. I took the document and I put it in front of her. Now, I laid it on the desk in front of her. You would think that curiosity alone, she would pick that out and thumb through it. She folded her hands and she looked at that and said, what do you want me to do with that? I said, this is a student's IEP. And she goes, you want me to read all that? She wouldn't even touch it. So computers sometimes just give too much information.
Right.
And I noticed that on campus, this is supposed to reduce the paper load. I think it's actually increased it.
Absolutely.
So, you know, computers, I'm not sure have been that significant of a change. Just, and what I told people back in 1984, just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it. And yet, because we can do it, now we do it. Becomes a real problem on campus. The other thing that I really wanted to do back then was actually assess whether the computers changed behavior. And there's very limited data on that still. We've been in this game now for 30 years.
Yeah. Actually, that leads me to raise the question about whether we are in fact asking the right question. Are we asking the right questions in higher education about technology? But are we asking the right questions at this institution? So that we've made this tremendous commitment for online education. In fact, it's become quite a commercial enterprise. People are making a lot of money off of this. Are those the questions we should be asking? I mean, I know that the logic is that or the rationalization or justification is that we've got to serve all these students. Accessibility is always the argument for all of this. But the question about learning seems to lag behind those issues of accessibility. Do you think we're asking the right questions about what kind of an education you get at Weber State?
I think we're trying to.
Okay.
I think we're really trying to ask the right questions. I think the problem comes with measurement. And I think it's very, very difficult to measure learning. And when you like compare a learning that goes on, let's say in a human development class online, a human development class, you've got to make a decision about, okay, how am I going to measure that? And often we come down to just computers, which is an objective measurement. And then we come back to factual information. But what you is very difficult to capture, and in my position, you know, where you're dealing with human relations, is the relationship part of that. How, if I'm a student in a classroom, and I'm hearing other people talk, I'm convinced as an instructor that that student is picking up information from the other student. Not only the factual information that they can talk about, the subject matter, but how that student presents himself, how that student addresses the question. And in the research on modeling, we incorporated all those. And, you know, I see this other student behaving a certain way, and I see what kind of effect that has. I'm going to incorporate that. And those then are translated in the workforce. As much, my personal belief in psychology, as much as the factual information I've learned about Piaget's theory or something like that. I'm interested in how these people interact. That's hard to capture on online class. These subtle things that are said, I remember in my education, it could be just the way I think, often what I found more important were the questions that students were asking or the way they were asking, not what the answers the teachers were giving. It was that, because often teachers don't give answers based on the questions they're asked. They give on answers based on the information they know. And the student doesn't want to follow up saying, no, that's really not the question I asked. Curious about this, and I knew I would sit in the classroom and go, well, that was a good question, and my mind would get on it. And so there are advantages in class that it's hard to measure when comparing an apple and an orange. And there may be some advantages online. I'm not familiar enough with online. Interesting enough, I've never been in an online class. I think that I've been in the first one.
Mm-hmm.
I did.
Why not?
I got interested in medical experience, getting involved in treatment programs. I'm now in line to try to do two classes. Also what I have found is that computers and online courses, you've got to be careful. All what you're doing is delivering text information in electronic format. And that reduces the computer to a book. And books are much better than computers at doing things, I think. My students have the option of doing an e-text. And for significantly less money, they can have the book online. And very few choose that option. And the few who do not seem to be impressed with it. They don't like the fact that they can't flip through the pages type. Maybe it's just habit or use to overcome that. There's also some different things. I personally do not, even now, feel that the technology has been captured in the way that it could be. And that's because of time.
Well, it also is, I think that, again, again, part of this question is from my own experience. I feel like I don't know enough to be creative in presenting that online class. So you're right. How much time and energy do I spend teaching myself or taking classes and learning how to be creative rather than use the computer as a delivery system rather than necessarily something that will create a particular learning environment or present materials in ways that I couldn't present them in a book or whatever. And I'm not particularly a visual learner. I'm a verbal learner, and so I also don't. I'm not. That doesn't appeal to me to use the computer for what the computer's really good at, which is of course a lot of visual information. So.
But it's only good at for people who are visual learners.
Right. I mean, right. So it's a real yeah. And so I don't know. And I worry that so many resources on the campus, both human. Literal, tangible resources have gone into this online delivery.
I agree. And I'm not sure that that the data is there to really support one of the proposals.
Thank you.
One of the things I have found in trying to use technology in a creative fashion, in a way that isn't just trying to take my classroom lecture and turn it into an online class or something like that. What I found is that it takes a lot of just doing it. You can't be pulled away from it. You've got to keep building on it and building on it and building on it. I was able to get funded an incredible for technology, what I think is beautiful. Down in the children's school, I have cameras now in all the labs. I have them hooked up to their own individual VCRs, which is hooked up to my own high-powered G4 Apple computer, that I can now take the video from the class, bring that into my computer, digitize it, edit it, add sound, and put that on DVD to allow students to have immediate feedback or quick feedback on their interactions with the children. The problem with that is it takes time. Every time I build some knowledge on what I'm doing here, then I get pulled away from it because I've got my workload, my course load, and all that. And I go back to it and I can't remember how to do it. So I'm starting to always learn again. And I keep hearing people about the online class. They switch the delivery system and that, and they have to start it all over again. It takes an awful lot of time. You really have to dedicate. And that means you have to have release time from something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things this campus has a hard time doing.
That's right. That's right. I was intrigued with Eric Jacobson that essentially the entity at Weber State called Academic Computing existed and ended with him. That he's the first to be hired, and when he retires, it disappears. And I was asking him about what it meant for him, because of course he came from an academic background also. His field was psychology like yours. And again, he was interested in computers as a learning tool, as a tool that might help children learn math, I think was his area. Do you have any sense of what it means to not continue an entity called Academic Computing? Do you have a sense that it means that we either have confidence that there's a critical mass of us that learn how to do this, or that we're, again, getting back to this issue about are we not asking questions about learning where we might then, yeah.
Your question is real powerful, because I want to add an element that I understand, whether I'm right or wrong. So you've got to take one step even back further than that. When you say that Academic Computing began and ended with Eric Jacobson. Eric Jacobson, what I remember, was brought in under instructional development. That was Joanne Kerfus.
Yes.
She was the director. And what was their role? Their role was to facilitate instructors in improving their instruction. So if you look at the history of that, the Academic Computing was an outgrowth of instructional development. Actually, I applied for that job, Eric Jacobson's job at the time he did.
Oh.
And so he came through under Joanne Kerfus's whole thing with instructional development at that time. She was just the director of the company. And so it really had a component component of how do we improve instruction. And we hired Jacobs, or Eric, into that position. And so it really does have an underpinning of instructional development, as opposed to simply just academic computing. And I think Eric really tried to hold on to elements of that. How do you use this to improve instruction? Not just how many computers do you supply a person, which department should get a computer. When we first started the procedure to allow individuals and departments and colleges to apply for funds, it was really to try to improve academic instruction. So the fund was for technology. It was not just simply computer technology. It was technology that would improve instruction. And though the bulk of it were computers, because that was exciting. I remember a guy up in health sciences that was one of the original people using, I think it was, I want to say, CD-ROMs. And this is way before the time he had his own old burner. This is interesting. So when I was involved, that really was. How does this going to improve instruction? Mine was not only public teachers, but also children. So, I'm not sure where Rancos Hall comes into this. I'm not sure what their true identity is, rather than problem solvers. Whereas, is the initial academic computing was not problem solvers, it was trying to allow people to become creators. I think they're a great job at doing that. Based on where we are at Weber State University, really need to understand that we are, as far as we are, given a small campus, given limited resources, we're given a huge online computer kind of history because of the foresight. I would say it was Rodney Brady at the time to just push this through in the middle after that. And once again, I give Joanne and Erickson, or Jacobson, Eric, a lot of the credit to just push that instructional development.
Yeah. Of course, Joanne left, and she continued to work in instructional development in other ways. In fact, it was under those circumstances that I actually met her, but I didn't know she had any connection with Weber State. So when I helped develop the Teaching Learning Forum, it's because there is no instructional development on campus that I can find. And the irony is that although I personally am interested in this, there's no mandate or there's no determination that somehow academic computing and the Teaching Learning Forum are going to be together. Now there are some efforts at that with the technology group that Tom gets involved with and Eric is, but it's not that same kind of I don't want to say consolidation, but partnership, I think, is the word that I want to say. It's not that same kind of partnership that seems to have existed at the time. And so it further removes, I think, certainly it has removed the online development. Is certainly not particularly informed by the forum or teaching and learning kinds of questions. I think there's an attempt, but that's really not where that is being developed or discussed. And I think it even matters all the more. What do you think in terms of the fact that it's being created by a completely almost separate part of the university, continuing education, whereas your experience in academic computing and instructional development were still housed within the larger campus. And I wondered if you might have a comment about Bob Smith in terms of the chief academic officer. Wasn't he supportive of...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Bob was. He saw it. You know, coming from his chemistry background, he understood this, and I received a lot of support. I was able to do what I was able to do primarily because of the administrative cluster, not because of what was going on in the department at all. It was like, I have to understand, I remember I was online. Nobody knew what online meant at that time. Yeah, you know, and you had to go through your telephone. And I was using my computer in my office and was doing all this data crunching online. So it's from my little computer here, I was able to tap into the main computer, which was unheard of then. Very few people were doing that. They would go up with sensitive, and I was able to dial in either here or at home. And the secretary came in and was furious, and she picks up my phone and puts it back down on the receiver, cutting me off completely from my data, because that's how you would get access. And I just lost all this information I was doing, again, online, so to speak. And I turned to her and said, "Don't ever touch my phone like that." She goes, "Well, your phone's been busy." Well, yeah, it was busy because that's the only way I could access it. But she didn't have a clue about what was going on at that time. My chairman nobody needed to know. And when I look back at that period of time, and what Tom, Day, and I, and a collective group of people, Eric, were doing on campus, we thought we were way behind the curve. We thought we were trying to play catch-up, when in fact, we weren't. We were, I know I look at it, I watch PBS, and I see what was going on in 1981 in a microcomputer. I was realizing that I knew almost as much about their computers as the people who were producing them. I was sent to a conference and I figured out a whole different way of programming. That's because it was so new to everybody. But you know, that only comes in retrospect. And it's just like right now, we are, I think, as a university, really doing a lot of stuff in the online that I have gathered at other campuses just aren't doing. I think we can do appreciation of it. But that's because of administrative support. Now, I want to address your continuing ed online class. It has me concerned. You and I have been on this campus long enough to remember a time when continuing ed ran virtually separate from the academic program. It was almost like it's university within the university. And then that was tried to be brought back under the university general umbrella. I know there was used to be jokes stated about how President Thompson almost had as much authority as whoever was in charge of continuing ed at the time. And that has me concerned, is that you start getting this other university running that then has to buy for funds, aid, and you don't get a cooperative thing. Very well end up with an antagonistic thing. Those faculty who don't teach online classes versus those who do. And I think you kind of see that with the funding.
Yeah, and this whole issue about supplemental pay, right, that's bubbling up. And you know, I hear my colleagues in performing arts saying, "I'm not going to be teaching violin online. It's just not going to happen. What does it mean to be a university to offer all of these programs, but to be mindful that there really are limitations, and that some of our teaching and learning is in a classic apprenticeship mentoring model that has been as long as there have been human beings, and hopefully will continue, but more and more resources again are going to this other delivery system.
That, again, I'm not sure has been demonstrated to be that good. And is it good in getting people a degree? No, I am.
Yeah.
But I'm still of the thought that an education and a degree are not necessarily the same thing. And that my primary objective is to get students an education. Hopefully they get a degree from them.
Well, and you know, the interesting thing, of course, is that, as you probably know, the first online courses actually came in really highly developed out of England in their Open University. And the notion was that, gosh, we'll make art history available to the cab drivers. You know, it was very much about kind of creating this more democratic or this more equitable, that anybody could could access the university who might want to take a Latin. They'd always wanted to study Latin. But in the United States, it's much more of a access and commercial model. It's very much, well, this is how the university is going to make some money. And individual faculty, this is how some individual faculty are going to make some money. And I don't know. I have philosophical concerns about a lot of that, but part of it is that I'm not sure I'm a very good teacher online. So, yeah.
Depends on how you
want
to measure it.
Well, my own befuddlement and the fact that my students keep saying, this isn't working, suggests to me that I'm just not skilled enough to.
It is curious to me on if people are given the choice of doing, that you can do online classes, but you have to do it online. How many people are doing online courses? And that should kind of tell you what online really is about.
That's right.
And I think the university is trying to move that way. Mm-hmm. You're welcome to do your online courses, but you're going to do an online, not an overload. And I think what's going to pan out from that is some of the faculty are going to go, yeah, because it's really conducive, I can do it online. Tom Day is a good example of that. He likes his online classes, and he has found that he would rather do an online course than in class. But I think you'd also find the opposite occurring, that teachers are going to go on to the online course for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And if I have to do it on mode, then I'm not going to. It's going to probably tell us as a university what those online courses are about. Are they just about the $1